Agile for Humans is brought to you by Audible.com. Get one free audiobook and a 30-day free trial at www.audibletrial.com/agile. Over 180,000 titles to choose from for your iPhone, Android, Kindle, or MP3 player, including Scrum, The Art of Doing Twice the Work in Half the Time by Jeff Sutherland, and Crucial Conversations by Kerry Patterson. Visit www.audibletrial.com/agile to enjoy your free audiobook today.
Processes and tools dominate today's Agile discussions, but we are devoted to the individuals and interactions that make it work. From the beginner to the veteran practitioner, we have something for you. Welcome to Agile for Humans.
Welcome back to another episode of Agile for Humans. I'm your host, Ryan Ripley. Joining me tonight, a guest multiple times over, Mr. Woody Zuhl. Woody, welcome back.
Ah, thank you very much. It's great to be here.
Always great to have you on, Woody. Thanks for joining us. Now, Woody has hooked us up with David Bernstein. David, how are you?
I'm very well, thank you.
So, David's an interesting guy. He has a recently published book called Beyond Legacy Code, 9 Practices to Extend the Life and Value of Your Software. This is published by The Pragmatic Programmer, so this is Dave Thomas and Andy Hunt's book publishing company. Great label, great brand. Really excited to start digging into David's book. You know, very happy you decided to join us, David. Thank you for being here.
Thank you. Thanks so much for having me.
Well, David, thanks again for joining us. Really interesting topic. So legacy code, the much maligned topic, right? No one wants to open up an application and have to deal with legacy code. And so the idea that you have 9 practices to help extend the life and value, really interesting. What led to, because a book's not simple, right? I mean, once you decide to write a book, you're taking on a monumental task. What really led to this book?
Great question. And I should also really mention that the book title is called Beyond Legacy Code. So a lot of people gravitate to it as a book about legacy code. But in reality, it's really about being beyond legacy code. Like the book Beyond Budgeting is really not about budgeting. It's about something else. So this is really about how to not get to legacy code in the first place, how to avoid getting there. Now, we talked a little bit about, you know, how to refactor legacy code, but I really focus the majority of the book on what good code looks like, because in order to take bad code and make it into something better, we kind of have to know what that something better is. So I focus on how to create good code.
So was it an observation that there's not a lot of good code out there? Was it people struggling to create good code? You know, what really, because every person I talk to that's written a book, they had this thing burning in their brain that was just upsetting to the points where they had to solve it through this activity. You know, do you have one of those kind of things?
Oh, for sure, for sure. And it's been 30 years in the making for me, because I've been a professional software developer for over 30 years, and I've seen a huge disconnect. And at first, I thought it was me. I just couldn't do software right, because I couldn't take this big waterfall project and sort of conceive of it all in my head and design it and then code it and then later test it and say, oh, look, it all works, because it didn't work at the end. And I thought it was just that I couldn't handle writing good software. And then I found that a lot of other people were in a very similar situation. And in fact, they, you know, have a label for it. They call it Agile, build incrementally, build the small pieces and then put the pieces together. And it made a lot of intuitive sense to me. But I noticed that as I was working with lots and lots of teams doing Agile and improving their Agile process, that they were stumbling on things that were really the technical side. And so I kind of feel like Agile software development has a lot to do with software development. And building software incrementally really, really is very different, I think, than building software in the way we were traditionally taught. You know, I'm an old guy, so you know, when I was taught, you know, the waterfall approach and building structured code and stuff like that. And really, the world has changed so radically since then. And I think that a lot of us are kind of struggling to catch up. So I wanted to write a book that really focused on why the technical practices work when they work, because I've seen a lot of teams work with the XP technical practices and not make them work. And then I saw a lot of pushback in the industry for things like TDD and other practices. And I understand the pushback because I've seen a lot of people fail with it. But I think it's not a problem of the practice itself, but how we're applying the practice. And so I wanted to write a little bit about how I've seen it work with teams. So that's basically it. I think these are the high value practices, but they're the technical side of Agile.
So we've had a number of guests who have come from the XP side of the fence. And yeah. So JB Rainsberg comes immediately to mind. I think Joe is one of the original, you know, XPers. He's old school XP. Ron Quartel is another very big into XP as well. I've seen a divergence. I'm wondering if kind of the direction or the observation that you've made too is that the Scrum, the frameworks, all of those pieces really pulled away from XP. And now we perhaps have these Agile teams that don't realize there's this heritage of technical excellence on top of all of these processes and practices.
Yes. Yes, I fully agree. And if you look at the authors, the original authors of the Agile Manifesto, they are all developers. They're all coders. So Agile came from a tradition of coding. And the challenge is that I think for a lot of non-technical people, coding is intimidating. It's kind of scary for high-level executives because they don't understand it very well. It's very different from everything else in our world, the virtual world. And I think that, you know, to try to manage that, that's why we got the waterfall process to start with, to give, even though we knew it was kind of the wrong thing to do in a lot of ways, but it gave us this feeling of security that we have a schedule and we can stick to the schedule and, oh, well, it was wrong, but at least we had a schedule. And now, you know, with building incrementally, it's kind of similar in the sense that I see a lot of teams adopting the simpler Agile practices like stand-up meetings and iterations and going, yeah, we'll get to that XP stuff later. And then they've accumulated so much technical debt that it's very hard to get to that XP stuff at that point.
Well, and an observation that's been made, and I think, Woody, we've talked about this in the past too, is that, you know, Scrum, Safe, whichever, you know, whether it's DAD, Less, all of these different frameworks, right? You can learn those in a week or two. But to really adopt XP, that's a 6-month investment.
Yes.
I mean, that's a level up. That is a increase in skill and a true investment in an employee and in your individuals and your teams, right?
Yes, most definitely.
And so there's a cost associated with that. There's an opportunity cost associated with that. And I think that's why it's easy to stand up in a meeting and say, hey, we're Agile. We stood here and talked for 15 minutes. Or, hey, we spent 4 hours in this room arguing about what's in the next sprint, and we're not sure yet, but we at least followed the practice and checked the box. But to actually adopt TDD. So, I mean, I've gone through this process. I think all three of us have. I mean, that's a mind bender.
Yes.
That is... that you're questioning yourself at all times. I mean, the insecurity and the, because as programmers, I think a lot of us are perfectionists. We want to be right. We want to do the right things. We want to know. We want to feel competent. And these practices really turn everything you know on its ear.
It's really true.
And it is a scary journey. But at the end, you know, of that investment, better code, more predictable, you know, all these things that we're after, but it takes effort.
Yes. Yes, I agree. And I try to boil it down to common sense because we're talking about, like you say, very technical practices. But the value of it, the reasoning behind it, really should make intuitive, logical sense to us. And I think it really does. So understanding that value helps drive us to use these practices correctly. You know, like you mentioned TDD, I think there's a kind of a movement in our industry that is sort of pushing away from TDD. You know, the whole is TDD dead thing and, you know, the talk of what they call test-driven damage. And I agree. I've seen that. I've seen a lot of test-driven damage in code, and I've seen a lot of teams doing TDD in a way that really becomes a huge impediment rather than helping them. So understanding the distinctions of how you can go wrong and how to avoid going wrong is absolutely critical.
You know, I recently saw David Heinemeier Hansen, the creator of Rails and a prolific Ruby programmer,
yes,
come out essentially against test-driven development. I think he called it the sacred cow that needs to be slaughtered and wants to move the industry on. I mean, are we at the end of test-driven development or are they overreacting to a few perceived problems?
That's interesting. And I feel like, and I've heard what he said, and I do agree with him with the idea that there are definitely problems, but they're fixable. For me, when I think of writing tests, I want to make sure that I write the right kind of tests and the right number of tests, because what I see teams doing is they get a little bit overzealous and they write too many tests.
So code coverage as a metric becomes problematic.
Well, interestingly, so let's talk about code coverage, because I think we got to cover the right code, first of all.
Right.
So you're familiar with the notion of cyclomatic complexity. It's the number of paths through a particular piece of code.
Yep.
And as cyclomatic complexity increases, of course, the complexity of the code increases. Therefore, it's harder for us to hold it in our hands. So if the cyclomatic complexity is above some threshold, like 3 or 4, then we really do want test coverage on that. But if it's
sure.
trivial code, then a lot of people think, well, we don't really need to have coverage for that, which is better than not covering really important code.
So you're saying don't write coverage for getter setters?
I think, and a lot of people say this.
I know,
it's
a
cool
goofy question.
If you feel that way, it's cool. I totally I understand it, and I'm totally good with it. But for me, the way I understand TDD is as a way of specifying testable behaviors. So,
right.
In other words, I look at my test space as a spec, which means that my assertions have to articulate behavior.
Right.
Now, I could walk you guys through this. It would actually be much more than an hour. It's a couple of days. But we could walk through it and be able to come to total agreement as to how many tests and what kind of tests are needed for any behavior. And that level of consensus is so powerful and empowering for people, because suddenly we're on the same page.
And I think it's like all things with Agile, right? You're expected to bring your brain, and you're expected to work as a team. There's not really, it's not prescriptive, and for good reason. I think the frameworks are good, the practices are good, but at the end of the day, the teams have to come together, think about their context, think about their domain, think about the risk that they're willing to accept, and then go forward, right? I mean, we have to think and engage our brains.
Yes, most definitely. And I think we also have to stand on the shoulders of giants, you know, of people who've made it work and model that. A lot of people think that unit testing is about writing tests for units of code, like methods. I don't think that was the original intention. I think that a unit is a unit of testable behavior. And so we want to write a test for a testable behavior, which is different than a method, because a method is an implementation. And a testable behavior, conceivably, is not an implementation detail. So when we refactor that behavior to make it, you know, more maintainable, then it doesn't necessarily break the test.
I always looked at it as testing intent. And so the intent of this method or these collection of methods is X, and I'm testing to make sure X works. And if I change the underlying methods that impact X, I know I'm safe because I can run my test. And that's how that always helped me frame it up, because again, this is a brain bender. I mean, you really have to put a lot of thought into, when you decide to adopt these practices, what your philosophies are, what your principles are. And for me, that one kept me out of a lot of mental crises.
Yes, I love that. I'm going to steal it.
In your chapter on practicing writing tests, you know, and so on, you talk about writing testable code. And I think that's something we often miss when we talk about TDD or test-driven development, is that it kind of encourages or essentially forces us in a way to write code that's testable, because the approach, you know, is to write the test first.
Yes. We're very efficient people, we developers. And so if we don't have to type a keystroke, we really kind of resist it somehow. So those 8 characters, CLASS space, curly bracket, and curly bracket, sometimes it's hard for us to be compelled to break something out into a class. But if you have 5 behaviors in the same class, you'd need 32 tests to ensure that they don't interact with each other. And which would you rather do, type in 8 characters or write in 32 tests? I would much rather write in. And part of I think the challenge is that we developers kind of are only seeing a slice of the value stream, of the development stream. And, you know, one of the things that XP and Agile are moving towards is bringing everything together so that, you know, we're doing QA at the same time and that kind of thing.
Yeah, definitely a good point there. So I was going through the 2B Agile site, which I really like your site, by the way. And there's a question that you pose, and I thought, wow, I love this question. but I'm going to put you on the spot with it because I think it's one that you said you can't answer, but I want to see if we can. And I know, Woody, I think you've got some background in this question as well. But I loved this question. What does it take to be a great software developer? Because you have a video on your site where you talk about, you can tell someone how to become a lawyer. Go to law school, start working for a firm, be a clerk, work your way through. There's a path to be a doctor. There's a path to be an engineer. There's tests at the end. There's these steps, and once you check the boxes, you get to go be that kind of profession. Programming's different. One of the best programmers I ever met is a music major, right?
Yeah.
Not the typical path you would expect to go into a quote-unquote engineering field, and that's a totally different argument, whether or not it's an engineering field. But let's say for argument's sake, it is. To have a musician move in and become a brilliant programmer, or a linguist, someone with a background in languages that spoke, you know, Spanish, French, German, multiple languages, suddenly code makes sense to them. You would expect mathematics, statistics, you know, these different disciplines, but there's these wide range of paths to get there. So what does it take to be this great software developer?
Well, that's an awesome question, and one that I've devoted my life to addressing. And I think that software development is one of the few things, the few human activities that really requires using a lot of our brains, both halves of our brains. You know, we have to be very disciplined. We have to pay attention to detail and be able to break things apart. But we also have to be able to integrate, to differentiate, to see the big picture. And that really turns out to be very much, in a sense, an art. You know, I've had a chance to work with and train over 8,000 software developers in my career. And one of the questions that I ask them is, what is software development? Is it more art or more science? I know there's elements of both, but what do you think? And it's interesting to note that it's relatively split. It's mostly split, 50-50. You know, some developers feel that it's pretty much everyone agrees that there's both, but some developers feel there's more science in it, and some developers feel that there's a lot of art in it. And I tend to agree, and I think that as we progress up and become more and more advanced, we're not really focusing on making something work as much as making it maintainable and making it understandable. So I think that we kind of, maybe the general consensus about what programming is a little bit different than what it really is. I think software development is both a linguistic activity and a social activity. And, you know, we developers are characterized as being, you know, bad communicators and stuff like that. And I think that nothing is further from the truth, that we have to communicate very complex concepts to each other. And the software that I think most of us build is a collaborative effort. And so we need these skills. It was interesting. Woody and I were both at the Agile Open Northwest a few weeks ago. And I noticed how deftly and easily that the developers were able to switch between talking about software development and talking about communication and learning styles and things like that. Did you notice that, Woody?
Oh, yeah, that's very true. Yeah, I think that was sort of the theme of the conference. It was, you know, how do we know when we're, or how do you know when you see Agile, something like that. And a lot of it, a lot of what came forward was really, you know, that the more in-depth thinking about, you know, what is it we're doing and why are we doing it? I think the why is an important part of it. And yeah, there was some great sessions that take things way beyond what we would think a developer is usually thinking about.
Indeed. And there is a human aspect to it. And that's one of the things that I love about you, Woody, is that you honor that and you bring that forward. And you too, Mr. Agile for Humans.
Yes. That's what we have here. That's really true. Because I think that what we kind of forget, I think, often is that the only code writing entity there is yet is humans.
You know, yes.
We don't have any way else to do this. So I think we have to honor that and understand that. And it's about communication. It's about being able to understand together, not necessarily agree. But understand together what the things we're talking about and come to a agreement eventually as to what we'll need to do. But essentially, it's more about the understanding. That's one thing I really liked about your book and why I wanted to be part of the interview today. It's just there's a deep vein running through it of practicality. You know, what do we do? What do we actually do? You know, it's like you cover the, I think, the philosophy behind these things, the reasons for them, and then you get to, well, what are some things we can actually do to exercise this? I think almost every chapter, if I'm not mistaken, covers, you know, a whole section on here's some of the practical things. You lead it. It's like I like to say, I'll say it right now, and that is if I had what it took to write a book, you know, I would have liked to have written this book, because this is just really a magnificent book, probably one of my favorites now, just on the idea of how do we go about doing this creative act that we're doing of software development.
Wow. Thank you. Thank you so much, Woody. Your opinion means a great deal to me. And I wanted to write it in a way that was not so much a technical book, but more something you could sort of relax into and read and get a lot of energy and pleasure from. But still be very much focused on these are the things that we really want to look at and provide value. So thank you very much, Woody, for that.
Yeah. So I would recommend, first of all, that if somebody wants to get started on these things, this is a good beginner's book because it clearly lays out, you know, you have, I believe it's nine different sort mm-hmm. of principles. I forget what you call them in the book that you're covering. And yes. And I think these are the things we need to be thinking about. I guess it's actually nine practices that you cover.
Yeah. Yes. Yes, indeed. Cool.
So, David, of the nine.
Yeah.
and I think we can, you know, this is always the cliche question, but of the nine, so for the developers listening, which practice should they go out tomorrow and just start grokking and getting their head around because it is going to be critical to everything else they do?
Well, that's a challenge because, in a sense, they kind of build on each other.
So what do you think then? So let's reframe the question to be more fair. What's foundational? So we asked the question, what makes a great developer? And we talked about, you know, there's social aspects and it's art and it's science, but what do you think is absolutely foundational? What has to be there for all of those other things to be possible?
You know, that's a great question. And I want to say what has to be there in order to do the technical side, because I talked about some of the non-technical things. And that's practice five, called Create Clean Code. And CLEAN is my acronym, at which I've overloaded because, you know, Uncle Bob has a great book called Clean Code, and Misko Havery has a phenomenal series of Google Tech Talks called the Clean Code Talks, really worth watching. So why not overload the term? And CLEAN is my acronym for the five code qualities that I feel are really the foundation that you can infer all the good principles and practices from. And they are cohesive, loosely coupled, encapsulated, assertive, and non-redundant. Now, these are simple qualities, and I'm sure we've all heard them from school, but I found that diving into them really deeply and thinking about them really deeply has helped me so much as a developer. It helped me understand what good code is so much. And also makes my code highly testable. So testability has a direct relationship to all those five things.
Well, and I think along with the test and these five qualities, it becomes immensely readable.
Yes.
Which has always been a problem within our industry. You know, there is this slant towards, well, just write your comments above it and everything will be fine. And you end up with novels within applications. And that never really made sense to me. Mm-hmm. And so the idea that I should write the code with intent, the test should be purposeful. And between those two things, I've really documented it. And some people disagree, but I think with those five practices or those five characteristics of code, along with a strong testing strategy, you probably cover it all, don't you?
Yeah, yeah. And it's interesting because at the conference, Arlo Belshi, another XP developer, said he looks for two things, which are the same things that you just said. He says, can I test it? Can I name it? If I can name it and I can test it, then it's probably okay.
Yeah, Arlo he's been a guest on the show and talked through some of his naming strategies. Something else that I think would resonate with you guys that Arlo was really big on and I don't know if he covered this up at the conference or not, is that he's not necessarily hiring for skill when he's looking for new employees. So he's looking for, can they work as a team? Can they collaborate? Can they communicate well? Do they have an inquisitive nature? Are they curious about how the world and computers and code works? And if those things are present, he can teach them programming skills relatively quickly. That's the cheaper skill to teach.
Yes.
And I thought that was interesting because it makes what we're doing. So in the past, let's say from the 70s up into 2000, it's a technical endeavor. It's a solo endeavor, writing code. And it's something that it was hit or miss. There's a lot of really good agile code written in the 70s. I believe that these practices originated well before the manifesto. There's also a lot of bad code written. And I think what we're seeing, and Woody's actually a pioneer in this, in my opinion, is the great social experiment of software development. So we are actually, we're mobs of people working together collaboratively to create clean, efficient, readable, beautiful code. And that's been an interesting shift from what I think was traditionally, at the beginning of our profession, how that was done.
And, you know, the other thing that relates to this that it kind of occurs to me is we lived in a different world than in terms of the resources that we had. If you remember, selectors and offsets, 64K boundaries. If you don't remember those kinds of things, I feel good for you, you know. But I had to suffer through that for many, many years. And we were always in a constrained environment. The very first Windows apps applications that we wrote, you'd write the, we didn't do priority based on value. We did it, what's the easiest thing? And then we ran out of memory, so we had to cut those features and write the hardest things anyway. But it was a very different world because we're constantly thinking about our constraints. And today we live in a world where it's really in many ways counterproductive to focus solely on constraints. Now, you know, there's always the need to do optimization, especially when you're doing things like, you know, high availability servers and stuff like that. But there's other constraints as well, maintainability and understandability of the code. And when these are at odds with each other, then we have to prioritize and understand the context of what we're working in to make the right choices. That's very
absolutely
creative.
It absolutely is. It's that innovative flair to code that out of necessity had to become prevalent. I don't have some of the older languages, but I'll tell you what, Malloc and Dalloc still find their way into my dreams sometimes and wake me up and I'm screaming. So those were bad. I love garbage collection in Java, and I love how Ruby handles resource utilization as well. But some of those old things were scary. Now it's so cheap to spin up a server. You get a Heroku server spun up. You can deploy Java or Ruby to it very quickly. I mean, for $15, you can have your own environment within minutes. It truly is amazing what you can do today, you know, compared to the earlier part of this profession. But yeah, the shift from the factory mindset to a creative social endeavor has just been fascinating to watch unfold.
Truly, truly. And, you know, philosophically, it has enormous impact on our society, the way we think about ourselves and each other. And I think this is one of the great benefits of the information revolution as opposed to the industrial revolution that is certainly, you know, kind of past or passing. And we're now focusing on and learning way different lessons than we did, you know, in that manufacturing phase. And we're learning the nature of information, really, because that's what the virtual world is. It's all about information and how information is organized. The virtual world doesn't obey the laws of physics, but it does have laws. And we just simply have to discover them. And when we do, we're not only going to be better developers, but we're going to be better human beings, too, I think.
I have to agree with that. I mean, it truly is the great social experiment. What we work on and do today will change the world forever. There's too much technology and too much software running people's lives today for it not to impact them. I mean, everything you get in your, you know, your home is temperature controlled by the Nest, which is adapting to you constantly. It knows, it's getting to where it knows what you want. You're turning your lights on and off with your smartphone. Your TV knows your viewing habits, and it can suggest television shows for you. You get into your car and it can brake for you. I mean, just the implications of software on life now are too great for it not to change our whole perception of how we interact and how we live our lives.
Yes, indeed. And I think like one of the most powerful things that came out of the space program was that picture of Earth from space. And I think there's going to be a lot of sort of conceptual metaphors that people are going to pick up from software that's going to influence them profoundly as well. It's not just the discoveries that we're making and the tools that we're building, which are amazing too, but it's the whole mindset and valuing information.
Yeah, and for me, it's the challenge of assumption. So there are these assumptions. I was just listening to a different podcast today where they're talking about how marathon runners used to think that a high carb load was the right way to go, but by putting sensors into the bodies of people and having software pull data out, they realized, no, a low carb with a, you know, this high glycemic diet, you know, all these different things. Counterintuitive. Right. But they were actually figuring out how they could restructure muscle by changing diet and how that would activate certain genes and all these different things going on that you would not know without software and without the ability to collect this data. But all of a sudden, we just understand more about how the body works, and that has to advance us. And that's just one of a thousand different things that now become possible. So fascinating stuff.
Yes, indeed. Indeed. And I think it's also sort of touching back to some of the things that are near or dear to you, Woody. It's really helping us connect and understand each other and value that level of connection and build communities. And this is all happening very, very fast. So that's exciting.
Well, so not to completely change the subject, but there's one thing I wanted to make sure I asked while you're on the podcast. And that is, it's actually an idea that's really dear to me. And that is that if we really approach software development well, we're going to write a lot less software than what we would normally write if we're not approaching it in an agile way. And you have a chapter, I think, that deals with that I wanted to maybe just have you do a synopsis of, perhaps. It's the implement the design last. The idea that if we let the project grow naturally to the size it ideally should be, then that's when we'll start discovering the result that we want for the design or for the architecture or whatever. So I kind of like to hear what you have to say about that. Maybe I'm off the mark there, but that's how I see that.
That's awesome. Well, I'll give you kind of my impressions, which is that, and I've thought about this a lot, I really can't think of a more inefficient way of building software than the way most of us currently do it. Because we're kind of doing everything out of our heads. We're, you know, we have this idea and we just simply start coding. I don't know of anything else. Even accountants do double book entry. You know, they do a credit and a debit to be able to check each other, to check the pieces and make sure that it's, you know, is correct. But somehow we're comfortable with the most obscure thing in the world, code, and doing it straight out of our heads. So kind of understanding, and having tools that sort of support us in doing it is really, really important. To implement the design last, the idea is just simply to do the bulk of our coding, especially kind of the risky coding, the coding that is building like a good design underneath, to do that when we have our tests in place and when we have everything running and all our tools that are there to support us, rather than just doing it out of our heads. So I find that what I love to do is And this is not an excuse for writing bad code. I typically will write something procedurally. It'll be good code, but it will be procedural. And then I'll refactor it under test to be more object-oriented. And I find that it's more efficient to do it that way. And it's also way safer because I'm transforming the code, but I have tests to support me in doing that. So that's one little trick that I find that's very valuable.
Yeah, I like that a lot. I found for myself, I have a story that I like to tell. I won't tell here, but the basics of it was I was working on some code that was very buggy, and it was not written with tests in mind. And we were spending maybe an hour or two a week fixing bugs in this code over a 6 or 7 week period. There'd be new reports all the time of bugs. So we took some time, set some time aside to go with the product expert on it, and I just asked him, let's write this anew, just based on the rules you know for this thing. And we sat down and started doing it. And after about an hour of doing that, they couldn't think of any more rules that we needed to, you know, to satisfy with the code. And we put that code into production. It never had a bug. It got delivered in production without bugs because it dealt with every known rule that they had in mind. That maybe they had to do the buggy version first to discover all those rules. But when we wrote the test-driven version, the design that came out of it was very clean, very simple. And the overall design of this chunk of code was what I would consider ultimately the most maintainable code, which gives you the velocity. I think you write about that as well, because you never have to come back and work on the dang thing later. You know, you gain a lot by doing that. So I like this idea of implementing the design last, with the idea that as we build the features into something, we can discover only what's needed and leave everything else out. Instead of trying to think up front what's everything that's needed, let's just clip it off one at a time. Anyways, I was hoping that, you know, maybe that's close to what you're saying here.
Yeah. Well, Woody, don't you have an Agile maxim that plays into that? Isn't it something? I'm going to get this wrong, but it's by doing the work, we know that the work that we need to do.
Yeah, it's in the doing of the work that we discover the work that we need to do, because doing uncovers reality. It exposes the real thing. And when we dig into something without giving it enough thought, Tom Peters talks about that as perturbing the system. Let's perturb the system a little bit so that we can expose the things we need to think about. Instead of just saying, I can think this all through, I wouldn't be so bold for myself as to say, I can think ahead of time of all the considerations for any chunk of code. But in writing the code, we could discover all those considerations.
I think also related to that, practice 3, integrate continuously, relates, because that's how we're building software incrementally. Ryan, you asked Woody on the last podcast that you had Woody in, what is Agile to you? And I realized that for me, it's a little different because I focus more on the technical side. And to me, the thing that really is the key thing for success with doing Agile is integrating continuously, is shortening that development cycle so that we're getting feedback as quickly as possible from our code. You know, they talk a lot about in the process feedback from the customer and stuff like that, but my build is my best source of feedback. And I want that build to give me instant feedback all the time. People like Arlo, he looks, if you look at his server logs, he runs his tests when he's coding about once every 20 seconds, so 3 times a minute. That's a pretty intense amount of feedback. And I think all of us could do amazing things if we had that level of feedback.
Yeah, you know, it's funny that you bring that up, because in my current versions of several of my talks, I bring up the idea that the missing word from the Agile Manifesto and principles is feedback, rapid feedback. Almost everything in there kind of is about feedback, but they just didn't use the word. I would have liked it if I think they used the word in the extreme programming principles or somewhere in the extreme programming book. But they didn't get it into the Agile Manifesto. I think that's a missing word.
You know, I'm fascinated by the idea of technical excellence improving velocity, because I think it's one that product owners do not understand. And it's one that I think needs to be brought forward, in that the time to do test-driven development, the time to do continuous integration, and the investment, because it's not a cheap practice, right? Mm-hmm. So you're making an investment in both.
Yes.
Getting to even where continuous deployment, which is, I think, even different than continuous integration. So getting to the point where your tests are automated, your integration is automated, and your deployment is automated, it's expensive, it's time-consuming, but it maintains the velocity that they need for the team, and it maintains consistency.
Yes.
But that gets lost, right?
Yes. I get a little stuck with that word velocity, because it's been so misused. Velocity is really a capacity measurement, not a productivity measurement. And a lot
so
of
let's shift it because
value. Let's talk about value.
I agree with you. I agree. I don't think so. I've seen Ron Jeffries online almost apologize for the term velocity, but it wasn't supposed to be a capacity measure. It was really supposed to be, I think, throughput, to pull a term from lean, which is why I like the work that Vasco Duarte has done, where basically he took story points versus number of stories completed and found that if you're counting cards or if you're looking at story points, the charts and the graphs look the same. Right. So whether you're counting points or counting cards. And so that means you can go back to a throughput mindset. It's not a capacity base like velocity. It's actually card in, card out. Mm. And I liked that a lot. And so maybe that's a different way to frame it that is more palatable.
I like that more. Yes.
But looking at that, so if they get the consistent, so what they want, right? What I believe what businesses want from development teams, since I am on the management side of a software development team. I no longer program. What I find that they're asking for the most is consistency. They want that predictability. The way to get it, I think, is through excellent technical practices and a keen eye for reducing and removing technical debt. But there's also pieces that go to it as well, that the second you take a person and apply them to more than one project, you've lost that predictability. Right. So now there's context shifting that comes into play that screws up how many cards we're going to finish in a month. Without XP and without some very good social practices like one project at a time and things like that, all of these other benefits just disappear.
Yeah. And again, in my interpretation, the idea of delaying. So the idea is to take a small bit of work from start to finish as quickly as possible, because that's when you get the feedback. And what happens is a lot of teams go to 99.9% done. They, you know, they don't quite fully integrate it, but they have the story done and it's waiting in a queue for QA somewhere. And I feel like that is really just sort of waterfall again, and that you really start to get the huge benefit when you close that loop and do the final, make it ready and shippable. And it, you know, continuous deployment is really not about necessarily deploying all the time. That's a business decision, and that should be decided based upon business factors like market cycles and, you know, maintenance contracts and stuff like that. But you should always or almost always write your software so that it is always deployable, because when you build software incrementally, that's the only time that we're consciously aware that we're building flexibility into our code. We developers have to go back into the code, you know, iteration after iteration. And because of that, we want to make it nice and clean and easy to work with, because there's nothing more embarrassing than to, you know, say, you know, oh, this code is really sucks, and then realize, oh, wait a minute, I wrote that.
Well, I think an interesting term, and I'm trying to remember who coined this. I think it was JB who said it. Every piece of code should be accidentally deployable. And so if you were to accidentally send it to production, it would not be a catastrophe. And I liked that kind of twist on it, because it reminds you, yeah, you can ship anything, right? You could have the worst piece of code and it's ready to go. But would you be happy that it went? And I always found that to be an interesting little twist.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's kind of, that's interesting. I'd like to see that, how that actually works. But so I think a lot of the concept of continuous deployment nowadays is the idea that you can keep your code deployable, and you go ahead and deploy it regularly without necessarily making the features always available to the end user. So I think that's okay, and I think that that's kind of part of what has to be done when we have larger things, like a lot of database changes need to be made and a lot of code changes need to be made. You know, you can't do that in a day. And so, you know, how are you going to go forward? But I believe kind of based on the idea that every feature we introduce is just adds the maintenance load of a project. Every line of code that we write adds, you know, to that same load. And we really need to be understanding what's important to deliver. It's more important to me to know that we're delivering the least amount that we reasonably can to serve the customer. And this is sort of the idea of just delivering what's barely sufficient and never anything more than that. Because as soon as we do, we've introduced more lines of code that we have to watch out for not breaking later, and more features that customers may find not useful, so we'll have to take them out later, and all that sort of thing. So if we can do this quickly, learn our lessons quickly, and then be able to remove things when we don't like them or the customers don't like them. So, you know, the book has legacy code in the title, so we ought to give you an opportunity to explain, if we haven't already, I don't think we did, exactly what is legacy code.
Oh, yeah, at least to you. Sure. There are lots of different definitions of legacy code. I like Michael Feather's definition of legacy code. He says the legacy code is any code written without tests. And that is because he puts a high value on testable code and having tests to support code, as I do. Tests give me confidence. So for me, when I don't have any tests and I have code that's really hard to work with, I don't have very much confidence. So to me, legacy code is code without confidence. And, you know, we kind of underplay the fear factor, but we're human beings, and fear is a very driving force for us. I can walk across the room, no problem, but if you put a plank up, you know, 100 feet in the air, I would have a very hard time walking across it, although it would just be the same as walking across the room. The big difference is what's in my head, but what's in my head drives me. So that's really important to have that level of confidence. So building software in the way that we've been talking about, incrementally, where our understanding is in the code itself. We're not making a commentary on the code in comments. The code itself is self-expressive, and it's testable, and it's also under test. And that, to me, is a much safer, easier, more fun way to live.
Well, so my definition of legacy code is slightly different. That is any code that we want to keep. To me, that's what legacy code is, you know? Any code that we want to keep. In other words, this is giving us some value. It may not be in great shape. It may be in great shape. It doesn't matter much to me. If it's stuff I want to keep running, then to me, that's legacy code. And much of what we come upon in what we call legacy code is code that's troubled. And even a lot of it doesn't even get called. You know, a lot of it, there's no path that anybody uses anymore that enters that particular chunk of code. So it turns into a nightmare when we're trying to work on something and we're not sure whether we're working on is going to affect some other chunk of code. And so we have to look through and follow every path through some convoluted thing. And we may not be able to catch, looking at it ourselves, whether this, you know, decision case or this if clause will ever actually operate. You know, it's like it will always be true or always be false when it gets to that point. And then who knows down that path. You know, it's like dead code, essentially, because there's nobody that ever gets through that path. And a lot of that exists. It's part of what makes legacy code so nasty. But it doesn't have to be nasty. And I think your book, when you talk about beyond legacy code, you know, there's a lot more to consider than just the legacy code itself. But there's a lot of time in every project, or I should say, there's much more life of the project that's dealing with legacy code than it's not, you know, dealing with code that is not what we would call legacy code. But if we think of it as the code that we wrote yesterday that we still want to keep today, then legacy code builds really quickly, you know. Yeah. It doesn't just start out, you know, as some big chunk of stuff. It starts out as some little things that grow.
Yes, and almost always it was initially perfect or very good, suited for its needs. But, you know, as software is being used, the needs change, and so software needs to be changeable.
I've got a question I want to ask you, too. Kind of lately, just something I've been noticing, because I've been doing a lot of workshops recently, and we do some TDD in those workshops, and I notice developers often going to the debugger. And I don't find myself very often using a debugger, so I'm wondering what your thoughts are about it, because I kind of, when I see it, I'm going, well, wait, why are they doing that?
I used to be a pro at the debugger. It used to be my specialty, and I've forgotten how to use it. I don't write bug-free code. I do write bugs too, but very often my tests pick them up, and so I spend far less time in the debugger than I ever did before without unit tests. And I'm test infected. I do everything test first, and I find that I rarely need to go into the debugger.
Yeah, for me, Woody, when I was still slinging Java code for a living, the only time I turned to the debugger is when I couldn't get the test to reveal what the spaghetti mangling of code was doing. And so it was very rare. Usually, as David said, the tests would usually uncover enough of the intent or the functionality of a feature that you can kind of get the sense. But there were a few times where some crazy variable, some scoping issue or something like that, where a value was getting set not quite right, that the debugger came in handy. But I've noticed that same trend, even developers on current and past teams, where you see it open a little too often and it's like, what are you finding in there that a test wouldn't reveal to you? So I think it is an interesting question.
So what I would like to see, like for myself, I would take, if I'm going to the debugger, I'm going, you know, there's something here I don't understand, and I want to get a better understanding. And so that kind of drives me back out of the debugger to go look at the code and figure out what could I test that would show me what I want the debugger to be showing me. So it's a signal to me that there's something that I'm not understanding. But still, it was just something I've noticed a lot recently. So there's one other thing I've noticed a lot recently, if you don't mind me asking about, and that is the idea that when we are in green and we're going to refactor, it's sort of been my practice for a while now to just keep it green. Don't allow anything to turn red while I'm in that refactoring time. But again, noticing in workshops, people will start in on refactoring something, and then there'll be five or six things that'll go red. And they'll say something to the effect of, oh, well, I'm refactoring right now. And I'm going, well, but it's red-green refactor. So we take a – so am I wrong? I guess it seems to me like we should just stay in the green when we're refactoring.
Yeah, as soon as we get out of the green, we're in danger, Will Robinson. So refactoring, sort of like you say, by definition should happen in the green. And the challenge is that when we're in the red, other things can break and we may not notice it. So that's why we want to stay in the green when we're refactoring. It's also kind of what we were saying before about how the idea of our tests should be about testing intention rather than implementation. And so if we're breaking tests when we're refactoring, by definition, we wrote implementation-dependent tests. So right. we want to be aware of that.
Yeah, I like that.
Arlo talks about this quite a bit too, where the tools need to come around to make refactoring safer. You know, he would argue that refactoring isn't necessarily coding, that we're moving pieces of code into new classes, or we're renaming variables, or we're doing these different things that a lot of the tools today can do automatically that should not break your tests unless you've written, these dependent type tests. But, you know, he's even taken a step further, and I'm still, like I said, with talking with you guys, it's, got to wrap your mind around a few of these concepts and come back for more discussion. But he's even at the point where he wants to see the tools doing that, so that refactoring is almost like a separate practice, I think, than programming. That it's a totally different, not totally different, but a different type of discipline, as opposed to writing new code. You're basically just manipulating existing. And so it was a kind of an interesting distinction that he made, that the tools really should be doing this, not the developer, and that's how you make it safe. So I'll see if I can dig up some links for the listeners on some of these different topics from some of these different people that we've brought up. So David, at the end of the show, and believe it or not, we've actually burned through an hour already, which this really flew by.
Yes.
So really enjoyed this conversation. At this point, we like to have the guests, you know, if there's anything they'd like to plug, anything they want to talk about that they have coming up, any events that that you have going on that you want to share, or just how people could reach out and if they have any questions for you to continue the conversation with you about your book or any of these ideas that we've discussed.
Great. Yes. Thank you. I don't really have to plug my book because you guys have done a great job of plugging it for me. Thank you so very much. I am going to be speaking at a few conferences coming up. If you're at going to the Scrum Gathering, that's coming up, when is that, like a month or so? And I think it's, where is it? I forget now.
It's Orlando, right?
Orlando, yes. And then Agile and Beyond also, which is in Ann Arbor, Michigan, and coming up in March. So those are two conferences that I'll be speaking at. And also just that this is kind of what I do. So if people want to get a hold of me, they can reach me either through Twitter, and my Twitter ID is tobeagile. TOBEAGILE. And my website is tobeagile.com. And so if there are teams that want to get better at XP practices, I can help. And if there's anyone who wants to just chat or share ideas, and you guys for sure, anytime you want to chat, I'd love to be up for it.
Great. Woody, what do you have going on in the next few weeks here?
This is great. It's not just a few weeks, depends on when this comes out. But thanks for the opportunity to talk about the Mob Programming Conference, May 1st and 2nd. It's going to be in Cambridge at the Microsoft Nerd Center. It's being done back-to-back with the Agile Games Conference that Agile New England puts on. And we have a little website for it, Mob Programming Conference. I think it's .com, but I'll look that up at this very moment while we talk. And I'd love to have everybody come who's interested in mob programming. It is .com. This is our first conference. We've been doing mob programming for almost 5 years now, and I've spoken about it and done workshops all over the place. But we all just thought, well, it's a good time to maybe it's the right time to bring people together who have got some experience and offer a couple days of mostly hands-on and sort of open space approach to a conference at a very fair price. It's going to be a very low price. And that'd be great. We can get a full house there. We've got mentors coming from all over the world. Some of the people who picked up on this idea early on from Sweden, from England. We've got Nancy Van Schuendewert, who's there in the Boston area, who introduced this to the folks at Bluefruit in England, and Alex Wilson from Unruly in London, Leonard Fridden from Sweden, who's been passing mob programming ideas around for the last 3 or 4 years all over Stockholm. So this is and a couple of the originals from the Hunter Group, Dexter Baga and Aaron Griffiths will be there, all essentially mentoring people who want to learn about mob programming. And who knows who will show up. We're hoping to get a good turnout.
That sounds great, Woody. Thanks for sharing that with us. Anything else you got going on that you want to share with the audience?
Boy, anybody who's interested in having a mob programming workshop brought to their company or their town, please get in touch with me. And it's easy enough to find me. I'm Woody Zuhl in Twitter, and that's the easiest way to get at me.
And we'll get links to all of your contact info in the notes.
Oh, thanks.
And I'm your host, Ryan Ripley. Let's see. What do we have to plug? So we will have we're bringing the podcast. We're taking the podcast on the road, guys. So we're going to actually be at Agile Indy 2016 in Indianapolis, Indiana on, I believe that's April 12th. We're going to be at Path to Agility in Columbus, Ohio. That's May 24th and 25th. I'll also be speaking at least one of those conferences, I think. But yeah, other than that, you know, we got a really nice note this week. A listener wrote in and said, hey, really enjoying the podcast. This has become a useful tool to help me improve my craft. And I thought, wow, what a humbling statement. And I really appreciated that note. I wanted to make sure to thank all of the guests that, you know, Woody and David, you know, guys like you come on the show and say brilliant things and influence people's lives. And so it's just it's a real treat to help facilitate that. And it's a very humbling experience to have someone say, hey, something that you're doing is improving the work they do. So that was wonderful. And a big thanks to all the other past guests who are hearing this just for making that moment happen. It was a really nice, nice note to receive. If you are listening to the podcast, if you're finding value, if this is something that it's become a part of your week, we'd love to hear from you. So leave us a comment on the blog site. Let us know how we're doing, what we could do better for you. You know, consider leaving us a review on iTunes. That helps spread the word about the podcast. It increases our audience and gets more value out into the world, which is really what we're after. Again, just want to thank everyone for listening. David and Woody, thanks for joining me tonight. This was it went by way too fast and truly a fun conversation. And thank you to the listener again for being here, and have a great night.
Thanks for listening to Agile for Humans. Let's keep the conversation going. Drop us a question on Twitter @AgileForHumans or visit agileforhumans.com.